This is panel 2156. Oh, heck, I'm up to my neck in student debt, which is actually kind of an assonance rhyme, but that's for English professors if we have any.
Okay, what's the number?
2156. Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Ophelia Morales, and I'm the moderator for this session. I am the Deputy Director of Financial Aid here at State Boulder. I have over 20 years' experience in administrative financial aid programs, so I have a little bit of knowledge about student loans. But today, I'd like to introduce you to the panel. We have, first, we have Reza Ramazani.
Perfect.
Reza is a professor of economics at St. Michael's College. Reza actually went to school here at State Boulder, pointed out the economics building on the way over here, and explained how he spent a lot of time being tortured there while he was a student here. So he went on to be a professor so he can torture other students. And so he has a strong connection to students and student loans and some of the problems that they face with debt. So welcome, Reza.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Second, we have Liz Blake. Liz is a former senior vice president of Habitat for Humanity International. Liz's connection to student loans, she actually served on the Ohio Board of Regents for 8 years, was the first woman chair of that, and during her time there, got to spend a lot of time on student issues related to access to higher education, and again, student loan debt is certainly a part of that. So welcome, Liz.
Thank you.
And last, we have Stephen Hayward, senior resident scholar at UC Berkeley, who has some strong opinions about student loans that he is going to shock us with today. So we will definitely look forward to hearing from Stephen. A little reminder, hopefully everyone silenced their phones. Okay, sorry, I was supposed to say that first. So welcome to the panelists, and we're going to get started. Each panelist will give their opening remarks. Reza, we'll start with you.
Thank you very much, appreciate it. Good morning, folks. It's always a pleasure to come back home. And when I told my colleague at my college I'm going home, they thought I'm going to Iran because I'm originally from Iran. I said, no, I'm going to go to Boulder because I not only got my PhD here, but I met my lovely German wife at CU. So I tell a lot of students, if you want to go to a good school, get a nice, good degree, and meet your future wife and husband, CU is the place. I think I have very close connection to this topic, being a former student myself, especially an international student when I started my PhD at this university when the revolution in Iran happened and was during the hostage situation, so I experienced a lot of financial challenges. And without the help of this wonderful university and economic department, I couldn't be here today. And I'm very grateful to this school, and especially a lot of my former professor in economics department. Now, and also I teach at the private college in Vermont. It's a very expensive school. And I have to remind my student, being a parent myself, how difficult it is for the parents. And the parents make a lot of emotional and especially financial sacrifices to send you guys to expensive school like ours. And you have a best full-time job. There's some student here, so I want to give him a speech. The young gentleman who is in high school, so I think it's good for him to hear this. When you are an undergraduate student, you have the best job in your entire life because everything is provided, and a full-time job you've got to spend on average 40 hours a week. So I feel as an older professor, I am a surrogate parent, and I need to remind my student how lucky they are. So let's start with the topic. The federal student loan program seems a great idea when we started in 1965. So you borrow the money, you go to college, and you don't have to pay it until you graduate. Also, the government, both federal and the state government, look at the higher education not as a private good. Not that something, you know, the degree you get because you're going to improve your financial situation, but if you went to college and you got a degree, not only helped you, but also helped the society as a whole. So the government, both federal and state government, look at the higher education as a public good. After you folks get your degree, you're going to become a productive, well-informed citizen of this country, and you're going to contribute not financially, but also in other ways. For example, when we have a well-educated population, they can make the correct decision of electing the right person for a president or as a representative. And when a politician making all those empty promises as an educated person, you are in a better position to analyze those information and ask yourself, are they telling the truth or are they exaggerating? And if I did it, they are telling the truth, what kind of evidence do you have? So that was the way we look at in the '60s, we look at the role of higher education as a public good and not private good. But unfortunately, things has changed in this country. Now we look at the higher education as a private good. I say, well, the parents are willing to dish a lot of money, the student willing to spend a lot of money, and they doing it because obviously they want to improve their financial situation. So the government, both federal and state government, step back. And again, I know some of my colleagues might want to, and they have a good reason. I'm going to also criticize the institutions from higher education like mine and maybe CU that we become more expensive. But we've got to know why institutions of higher education is more expensive, because they're giving unreasonable salary to their faculty. Do they have a lot of administrators? We've got to look at those factors. So I'm hoping, you know, we have a very open discussion, and we provide you with a complete story to tell the good, bad, and the ugly, and not really just using, you know, just criticizing the institution of higher education as a source of a problem when the student facing, or the parents, and also the parents are facing huge student debt. Now let me get you start with some of the numbers. I think that's very important at the beginning of this talk, that we distinguish between what has happened to higher education, public good versus private good. Now, student loan, as some of you know, is the second highest consumer debt category behind the mortgage debt. It is bigger than credit card debt and also out of it. And there are more than 44 million borrowers with $1.3 trillion in a student loan debt in the United States. And the average student debt in class of 2016 was around 37,172. And I think that's a huge number, given the current economic condition. When the parents have spent a lot of money and the kids have spent a lot of time dealing with a goofy professor like me, they have to find a job that is going to provide them with a salary, number one, that is going to pay their living expenses, and then some more. Because right away, they start paying those loans. And obviously, you cannot file for Chapter 11 like a big corporation if you are not able to pay the loan. So I'm sure my colleagues are going to talk about that issue. And this is, I think, is a reasonable criticism, you know, when it comes to the institution like CU maybe and my own college. The cost of the university per student has risen almost five times, more than the rate of inflation since 1983. But unfortunately, the salary of the kids after they graduate stay flat for the past 10 years. So there is a little bit disconnect between how much the parents and the student paying for the tuition, getting the undergraduate degree, and the salary. If both of them are moving proportionally, I really don't see any problem. But here, you know, the cost of the education increasing five times more than rate of inflation, and the salary is completely flat. So I think we see the disconnect, we see the gap, and I think it's a major issue. Now there are also, but again, we gotta be honest. As an institution, we have to ask ourselves question, because now a lot of pressure, college and university, about the assessment. We make a lot of promises to the kids and the parents, you know, come to school, study economics, X, Y, and Z is going to happen. Is it true in advertising? What kind of evidence do we have that we deliver what we promise? And I think now a lot of colleges and universities, they are using different procedures to come up with assessment. You know, being older faculty, I think, has some advantages. I told my dean, I'm really not going to do all this paperwork, you know, to write all this report. For me, as an older professor, the best evidence or assessment is what is happening to my kids after graduate and got a degree in economics. And I'm not talking about what percentage of my former student got a job. The question is, did they get a job that related to their field? And I think I want to also provide you with some disconnect that shows, yes, the kids has an undergraduate degree, but do you really needed that degree in order to get the job that they currently have? So 42% of a graduate are in a job that require less than 4 years college education. So as a parent, I'm going to be very disappointed. If my kids got a job that they didn't need a college degree, spend a lot of time, spend a lot of money, he didn't need that degree. And then also as a professor, I should have some responsibility. As an institution, I think we also should have some responsibility. What we are doing? Are we teaching the right subject? Are we offering the right courses? And how do we know our students prepare for the jobs that are currently available after they graduate? Now, 41% of the graduates from the nation's top colleges, could not find job in their chosen field. 41%, and these are top colleges and universities, they couldn't find a job in their chosen field. Half of all graduates said they would choose a different major, hopefully all of them become econ major, different major or a school. Only 39% of the managers feels the students are ready for workforce. So, again, we've got to, as a professor, as an administrator at the University of Institutional Higher Education, we've got to pay attention to those numbers. 4 million jobs, unfortunately, and this is one problem we have in Vermont, 4 million jobs are unfilled because job seekers lack the skills employers need. So that's another disconnect we have. But no, okay, that's a gloom and doom. Now, at the same time, I got to say it's not our fault. It's not all fault as a professor, as an administrator, or as an institution. There is no question that higher education is costly. No question. It is more than families and individuals can afford. There is no question. But same thing true with other expenses. Healthcare, housing, cars, mortgage, whatever you want to call it. But let's look at some of the advantage. Higher education is one-time cost. You don't have to replace it. If we do our job correctly, you don't have to replace it, and we don't have to repair it like the car. You have to replace your car, you have to repair it. So, and also, it's going to open up a range of occupational and personal opportunity for the student's entire life. Now, just let's look at the financial advantage. I was in a similar panel a few years ago. And after gloom and doom, there was a father who said, I have 3 kids. I'm not going to send them to college. Ain't worth it. And we see this from a lot of parents, which I think is absolutely wrong and is short-sighted. Job of the economist to do the cost-benefit analysis. Even with all the expenses that students are facing to get an undergraduate degree, higher education is one of the best investments. It has highest rate of return. You look at the stock market, you look at the housing market, and you compare it to the education, it's still highest rate of return. College graduates age 25 to 32 who are working full-time earn about $18,000 more, at least $18,000 more in their lifetime compared to people with only high school. But I want to go back to what I said at the beginning of my talk. Getting degree or going to institutional higher education, the purpose should not be only achieve financial reward, which the result is there. You're going to be better off if you have a college degree. But I said, we've got to go back to the notion that higher education is not a private good, it's a public good. And as someone grew up in a very poor family in a different country with the parents who were not well educated, but they recognize the power of education. I might be biased, but I think education, we talk about poverty, we talk about income inequality, we talk about a lot of social problems in this country and many developing countries. I am a firm believer that in order to break the vicious circle of poverty and solve a lot of our social problem, I think education is the solution, especially the higher education. So my advice to the parents and the students, yes, it's expensive, less a student debt is very high, but in the long run, it's going to pay dividends. Financially, it's going to make the kids better off, but also as a society, we are going to a better place when we are dealing with a lot of informed citizens. I tell my students, we are, and it is true, as a college professor, the students who are taking my courses, we are privileged people. We, obviously getting advanced degree or getting undergraduate degree to help ourselves and our family, but at the same time, we have a moral obligation. Also, I teach at Catholic College. We have a moral obligation to become a spokesperson for the rest of the society, because a lot of people, they didn't have the luxury to go to college. They have two or three jobs. They don't have the time nor the knowledge to listen to goofy politicians, to sort the facts with fiction and make an informed decision. And I think that's something that sometimes we overlook when we really question the cost of the higher education. And in some extent, I think we blame the university as spending a lot of money. So I have other ideas about how we're going to solve the problem. But I think it's fair to say, as an institution of higher education, we hear you as a parent, we hear you as a student, and we're coming with the concrete procedure in order to maintain the cost, to reduce the cost, and help our student, you know, to get an undergraduate degree, to become an educated person. For example, what we do in our college, and I think probably it's true at CU and at colleges, we're coming with accelerated program. We are trying to help our student and their parents in a state spending 4 years to get an undergraduate degree, to finish it in 3 years, and the parents can save between $50,000-$60,000 by encouraging the student taking courses during the winter break, during the spring break, and also summer courses. But also something that I have to say before I give the podium to my colleague, we're also facing new challenges that we never experienced before when I was undergraduate. Some of you were undergraduate. Now, we have the student not only have the financial challenges, but they have a lot of other challenges. For example, learning disability, I think, is a very important factor and is a very expensive factor for us, because according to law, we have to accommodate our student that they are in that particular category. So we have to come up with the new offices, we have to hire new people. For example, in some cases, we have to have a note taker for the student, we have to have a special place for the student to take the exam, and those are, I think, part of the additional cost that this day some colleges and universities are facing compared to 30 years ago, for example, when I was a student. And again, also demographic is changing, the number of the American student at a college level is decreasing, and as you know, now a lot of colleges and universities, including I'm sure CU, is desperately looking to attract more international students. I always remember we have a lot of Chinese students, we have a lot of Japanese students, and I tell my American students we've got to be very nice to our foreign students, because they are the one, they are paying the full tuition and enabling us to provide American students with a discount. So I don't know what happens in case the new administration impose, which already we see, you know, with immigration, because I don't think some of these policies are going to help the colleges and universities, and some of the, we have seen the result the past few months, the number of the graduate student, international student coming to colleges and universities in the United States decreasing. I have some of my Chinese students, they prefer to stay here for a graduate program because they're graduating in a few weeks. But they decided, based on what happens, it's a fear factor. They decided, well, we don't want to stay in the United States for the graduate program. We want to go to Europe. So I want to stop at this point, and I want to give the podium to my colleague. Thank you very much.
So lucky for you that Reza went first, because most of my little gibberish I now don't have to share with you. We consulted the same sources. My data shows that the amount of student debt is actually $1.6 trillion as of the Federal Reserve numbers in April. But other than that, I completely agree with all the number. I wanted to talk about two things related to it. One I know a little bit about, and the other is pure speculation. The first thing that I know about is what the implications are of the student debt burden. And we had a great set of commentaries about it from the parents' and the students' perspective. I wanted to move slightly into the community aspect of this, which is that with 44 million borrowers out there, and that average student debt of $37,000 for 2016 graduates, you also have higher default rates and delinquency rates. And the default rates are at the moment, and delinquency is measured at more than 90 days of not repaying after being asked nicely. So it's really a serious default. It's not just kind of being late. The number is at 11.2%, and that's reported. I'll tell you that is underreported, because institutions do not want you to know how much pressure the students are on. So that's an underreported number. And it's higher than any default rate of any form of consumer debt. So that's one alarm bell that goes along with it. The second we've talked about was the low income opportunities for recent graduates. And I have three, I'm blessed with the three most perfect children. You may have wonderful children, but mine are more perfect.
Love that one.
And my middle son, Asher, graduated from Vanderbilt in 2008. And he had one low paid job for a year, then got 2 years in a job, got laid off, and then spent 3 years with a Vanderbilt degree, effectively unemployed. And it was that perfect storm of the 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009 economic collapse. The reasonable reaction, I think, on the part of the corporate community to freeze hiring and not add new people. And then all the recent graduates came out with new shiny degrees, and he was in this little vortex. He ended up with a fabulous job, and he will recover. But I saw firsthand that crunch of the kids that had the student debt, that had good degrees, that had the reasonable sets of expectations, and couldn't help but get into the situation of defaulting. And so it's not as though kids are being, you know, errant, although some of them are. In terms of how this student debt plays out, I think there are a couple of unintended consequences of it. And this is also a highly personal experience, but I have data to back up the fact that I am the mother with no biological grandchildren, although I have five fabulous step-grandchildren. And part of it is that kids graduating from college with student debt are delaying getting married. They are delaying having families. There's one exception to that. And they are delaying buying houses. And I think you heard from the intro, I've spent 10 years at Habitat for Humanity. And Habitat, you think of as a nonprofit. They don't actually give anything away. It's a loan mortgage project with volunteer labor. But it's the 10th largest home builder in the U.S. So I'm very familiar with affordable housing and housing trends, and kids in this age of having graduated from 2004 to 14 are more likely to be living with their parents, mm-hmm. and they're highly, highly unlikely to be buying a home, and most of them actually aren't taking out car loans for new cars. They're part of the good used car market. In terms of the marriage delay, there's a guy at Johns Hopkins who's actually done an analysis of it. His name is Andrew Cherlin, and he said that the most important central concept to marriage in a traditional marriage context is some economic stability. And when one, and more in this case mostly two, of the potential marriage participants have major student debt that they're not sure that they can keep up with, it's a deterrent. It's actually something that, according to Cherlin's study, partners hide from one another. They don't want, they're embarrassed about having the level of student debt that they have. It's a shame that there is that set of circumstances, because there are refinancing and consolidation and loan repayment programs that are available, but most of them are not accessed by this. The marriage delay results in the delay for children, except where you don't have a college degree. And the data show that if you don't have a college degree, you're going to go ahead and have the kid anyway. You'll live with the father as a woman. You'll live with the father, but you won't marry him because his financial prospects aren't that good because he's got student debt. But you're not going to delay. And interestingly, the college-educated folks are the most likely to delay having children as well. Realtor.com's done an interesting study. The best data on this actually comes from the New York Federal Reserve. Reserve banks, as you know, divide up the areas they're expert on, and the Federal Reserve. And I wanted to read you, before handing the mic over, a couple of paragraphs for this. First is the, and this is a 2015, end of 2015, speech on the impact of student debt. And it says, the individual and macroeconomic implications of growing student debt go well beyond the high default rates and may not have been sufficiently anticipated or understood. Our research suggests that the sharp buildup of student debt has contributed to large behavioral changes among the millennial generation. First, among those with student debt, a growing share continue to live with parents. For example, we see states that have experienced sharper climbs in average student debt per graduate since the recession have also shown steeper growth in the rate at which 25-year-olds live with their parents. Similarly, our research suggests that student debt has contributed to a decline in home and car purchasing, as shown in the chart, blah, 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 blah. The most serious econometric research indicates that relationships between increased student debt and higher education co-residence with parents lower the home buying at age 30 and are in fact causal and exist whether or not one controls for educational attainment. The speech is worth taking a look at, but I wanted to go to the end to say what they think the primary policy implication is. A primary policy challenge in higher education financing is to increase access to higher education to more people through grants and loans, but in such a way that the private and social net returns remain positive. This requires a combination of financial support, but with sufficient livelihood of success, ability to repay, and positive returns. So the point that this doesn't raise is how localized the solutions need to be. And by this I mean, I was on the Ohio Board of Regents. Ohio created something called Choose Ohio First, and they had a lot of aerospace engineering and they wanted STEM graduates. So they paid for STEM graduates, and they paid regardless of your economic. But that public policy choice now means that there's a fabulous set of engineering graduates that are meeting that localized state need. So there was a state policy to take revenues from the prison system in that case and apply it to more engineering graduates, and that was done on a state basis. In Georgia, where I live and have lived for 10 years, they have the HOPE scholarships. And when my kids were applying to college, my oldest is almost 34, he wouldn't have applied to Georgia if it were the last school in the world. It was a state school. It was kind of so-so. I'm now on the board of the most selective high school in Atlanta. It's called the Westminster School. And their top graduates go to Georgia. And it's Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Georgia. And it's because the state, without regard to income, made an investment in the Hope Scholarship Program, again, making a choice of taking tax revenues and putting it towards a higher education product that caused people, and they did it because they said when somebody studies in Georgia and stays in Georgia, the Georgia economy goes up, and in fact, it's massively expanding. Georgia Tech is a beneficiary of this as well. So student debt is a huge problem. It's a tax revenue problem. It's a public policy problem. It's the choice of legislators, and it's a choice very much on a localized level. The one factor that I will speculate about that I don't know, but my husband, who's way smarter than I am, shakes his fist at. He went to Harvard, and he will never give them a dime. And among other things, that's for a lot of good reasons, he says that he thinks higher education, bricks and mortar, institutional higher education, is a dying phenomenon, the denying set of institutions. And there are lots and lots of models that show that you can come to a classroom, meet your teacher face to face, do that bio language, but then take the rest of the course online and come back for an exam. And the cost of delivering that education product is significantly less. So as we look at all of the solution has to be one that includes all players, but I would push the institutions, whether it's St. Michael's or Boulder, to see how many more kids they could educate with distance learning, not to go the Phoenix route, but how is it that we as a society educate more people but address the cost of not paying professors less, but being much more creative about the ways we teach, because the student debt burden is unsustainable, but the costs don't need to be quite so high.
Very good.
Thank you.
So I think I'm going to stay down here because I'm going to be, I think, fairly brief, but ornery about it. I'm really going to throw down on the subject because I think this ought to be a scandal. And it isn't a scandal. I'll give you a theory why in a second. But it's already been mentioned. A student loan debt is, what, 1.4 to 1.6, whatever, right? You know, a lot, right? It's an enormous amount of money. Well, what's the driver of that? Well, it's the high cost of education. You know, we've been going through this national debate for years about how healthcare costs are rising too fast. Cost of higher education, public and private, has been rising at twice the rate of healthcare costs. Why isn't this front page news? Well, who runs universities in this country? Liberals run universities in this country, almost uniformly. There are a couple of exceptions I'll come to that will provide a dramatic contrast and show you what the problem is. And I wonder if there's a connection between high student loan debt and the higher cost of education. I want to puzzle with that question for a minute. But I think, you know, why is the New York Times not making this front page news? Well, it's their friends who run the universities. I do think it's that simple. So great idea to let more students have access to universities by having low-cost or low-interest rate subsidized student loans. But, of course, how are institutions going to respond to that environment? Like any institution, if you offer subsidy, they're going to arrange themselves to capture the subsidy. Imagine if car prices had gone up like college costs have gone up. Well, you'd have much bigger debt for car loans, much bigger defaults on car loans. And if you had a scheme for car loans like student loans, how would car dealers react to that? And by the way, isn't it a curious thing that dealing with private universities, not so much public ones, but private universities, which behave like a cartel, that's another thing that ought to be a scandal. You know, they have the rate, you know, stated tuition, room and board, $65,000, but nobody actually pays that, except very rich families do. But you always negotiate like you negotiate with a car dealer. But if any of you here, some of you students in the room, probably filled out the FAFSA form. Exactly. Why is that form like that? Because of the federal government and the way the student loan program works. But it's an information tool for the cartels of the private universities who will give students almost the same price when you negotiate with each other. It could, I obviously think it could be an antitrust investigation of private universities who behave this way. So I mentioned that there are a couple of conservative universities you can point to. Then I'll come to my provocative reform ideas. So there's two universities I can think of that are run by conservatives. One private, one the other one's Purdue, a large research university run by Mitch Daniels, former Republican governor, former director of office and management and budget, and an old-fashioned Republican fiscal conservative, right? What's the first thing he did when he became president 5-6 years ago? Froze tuition. Held tuition frozen for 5 years, I think, while everybody else was still going up 5 to 7% a year. Well, how'd he do that? Well, he let he thinned out a lot of administrative positions by attrition. He sold off the car fleets for the universities. We don't need our own car fleet. He stopped purchases of new furniture. We've got lots of desks sitting around. Yeah, they're old and beat up. We can get by with those. But a lot of universities think we can just pass on the cost through student loans, exert no financial discipline. And then you have the administrative bloat of public universities. So, you know, I'm at the University of California, where 30 years ago you had one administrator for every, you had one administrator for every two faculty members, so it was 0.5 to 1. Today it's 1.1 to 1, 1.1 administrators for every faculty member. And a lot of them make, you know, if you have your vice chancellor, we're about to hire a vice chancellor of inclusion and diversity, which is about politics, everyone knows that, not about classroom instruction, and that person will make $300,000. And meanwhile, I have my students telling me they can't get enough classes because of budget constraints in the department. You know, I offer to take extra 40 students in my lecture class. I have 162, and they say, well, we can't do it for all these different rules of the budget. And then students can't graduate in 4 years. So by contrast, I mentioned Purdue. Hillsdale College is my favorite because the president is Larry Arnes, one of my oldest friends. They decided decades ago not to take any federal money because they didn't want the regulation that came with it. The federal government came back and said, well, but you know, if you have students with student loans, you're subject to regulation. So they said, fine, we won't have any students with federal student loans. So they've raised money ever since to make financial aid available outside the federal government purview. They don't have vice chancellors for diversity and inclusion. They don't have $300,000 Title IX coordinators. They don't have all the other layers of deanlets and all the rest of that. Tuition at university, $25,000 a year. Compared to Baylor, which is 40,000, right? By the way, veterans, they also can't participate in the GI Bill, so they've raised money that any veteran can come to Hillsdale for free. By the way, how do they rank? I looked up the numbers on this. Average ACT score at Boulder is 26, Hillsdale 30.5. Academic rating by the Princeton Review, Boulder 77, Hillsdale 95. Admission selectivity by Princeton Review, 85 for here, 94 for Hillsdale. I've actually been trying to persuade Larry to do a survey of his recent graduates to see what jobs they've got, what salary levels they've got, some of the social measures like getting married and buying houses, and compare them to Oberlin or some comparative liberal college, and you know he's intrigued with the idea. I'm convinced the numbers would come out very embarrassing for Oberlin and your liberal arts college where people load up on student loans. Here's my ideas. One is, maybe we ought to have the universities have some skin in the game. Since rising costs are the driver of this, how about we say to all universities, for every student who defaults on a student loan, you're responsible for 50% of that amount. Then they'd have an incentive to hold costs down. Second, and I'm quite serious about this, I think most universities simply ought to fire half their administrators at random. It wouldn't matter. I don't think you'd miss most of them. And those are my opening positions. I have others if you don't like those, as the old Mark Twain line goes.
Very good. After all the gloom and doom, I'm glad I'm an old professor and I'm getting ready for retirement.
Look, with every, you know, every administrator you hire, you can hire two professors, right?
Do we have some time to respond to one another?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and then I think we open it up to question
yes.
and answer.
Were these amazing opening remarks, right? Okay. Yes, thank you. Definitely heard a lot of things about college costs, distance education. I think there's a kind of a couple things there that you guys might want to just continue on with that conversation. I definitely saw when you mentioned distance education, Reza's side.
Yeah.
You were thinking about that.
It wasn't shocking to me. I was expecting that, to be very honest with you.
And well, we met yesterday, so.
Yes, and I've got to agree with you. You know, I think that what is unique about this conference, and this is probably my fifth or sixth one. When I go to economic conference, I'm dealing with the cult. We have the same religion. We understand each other's language. We don't challenge each other that often. You know, we say, hallelujah, you're right, now let's go have a drink. But I think the beauty of these conferences, and I think lately they have done a good job to bring people from different perspectives, and I think it's good to mix it up a little bit. And I think especially as a college professor, we owe it to our students. So I totally agree with you when you talk about, well, you know, the institution of higher education has been hijacked by a certain group of people. There is some truth in that. But again, at the same time, I got it. First of all, you made a comparison between Hillsdale and CU, which is a little bit unfair because we are not comparing apple with oranges, because some public school, they're under pressure, you know, to have a diverse group of students. Some of these students are low income, some of the students are not prepared. So I don't think that's quite a fair comparison when we compare a big university, public university, with a private, a small college like mine or the Hillsdale. Now, but I want to also say, look, you know, in part of the culture, we shouldn't really use the universities as a scapegoat. I agree with everything you said, especially coming with the administration. This is a challenge we have in not a small college, because I have been there for the past 32 years. The number of students stay the same. Number of the faculty is going down, but paper pusher, forgive me, number of a paper pusher keep going up. We have a vice president of X. We have a vice president of Y. And I think I agree with you, but the problem is, there is a competition among private colleges. We have to be performing exactly the same way. And I think the part of the problem is American culture, and maybe it's culture in some place. We measure quality based on the price of a product. Hmm. I tell my students, if you want to impress the young lady or a guy when you're going to go to dinner, when you look at the wine list, what do? Oh, I'm going to order the most expensive bottle of wine, because the kids assume, or a lot of assume, the price associated with the quality. And I've got to be very honest with you. We're a private college. We're competing with a lot of other colleges. We check their tuition.
Yep.
If they're 50, 60, we got to be in that range.
Yep.
Because if it's our 30,000, their parents said, oh, college X is charging 60,000 a year. You goofballs charging 30. So you guys are not as good. And I got to be honest. Again, you talk about your children, and I want to share my own experience. My daughter started looking for colleges, and we visit, God knows, maybe 22 colleges. We are at Gettysburg College, college number 15. So the people from college asking the audience, how many colleges have you visited so far? 3, 4, 7. They got to my daughter, I don't know, it was 14 or 16, and everybody turned up. I was so embarrassed, I got up. I said, I'm not with them. I'm just driving them around. But be very honest, you know, it was good for me as a college professor to pay attention what question people were asking. And I mean it, visiting those many, especially mom, with all the respect. What time the cafeteria is open? If my kid is hungry, where are they supposed to get the food? They were measuring the size of a bed, you know, the dormitory, honest to God, the exercise place. But nobody asked. And I'm a college professor. I was hoping one of those parents, how about the quality of your professors? What the parents see when visit those colleges, the dormitory, the gym, you know. But we are not there as a professor. And when you look at me and look at another professor, you don't know which one was good, which one was lousy. So people don't ask that question, and I think that's a problem. So be honest with you, Pierre, first of all, with the tuition, you're right, we're competing. And also, we got to come up with a new building. And what are we doing? And this is a disservice. I got to hear it. I'm glad you started this. We do the student disservice because we create an environment of a club med. Got to be honest with you.
Yeah.
We do the kids disservice. Fancy cafeteria, fancy gym, fancy dormitory.
Climbing wall, that's the big one.
We have
climbing wall.
No, that's actually good because I make their life miserable. They have to climb
the walls.
I have no problem with that one. Then they can vent. And they're going to cost me and my family. But on a serious note,
liability insurance.
Then you have it. That's even
more expensive. That's the federal government's going to regulate that.
But this is it. But honestly, these kids get used to that lifestyle. So what happens? They're expecting the same thing after they leave my institution. So what is going to happen is going to a hard landing for those kids, because they're going to face a dose of reality. They cannot find a meaning job. They find a job that barely pay their expenses. They have to have 3 or 4 roommates living in the same. This is what I experienced with some of the kids. And I think that's the problem. Because we, and again, you're right, some people are, and I think it's a valid, we pamper sometimes our students. We want to protect them constantly. And we do it all the time, honestly. Because number of students is dropping, we're doing, but I think, but and I agree, and what we do, because we got to give the kids the dose of reality. I tell them, you think I'm mean, I'm nasty? You haven't seen anything after you left the institution.
Well, it's...
So can I,
sure. Yeah,
can I go next? Yeah. Because I am sitting in the middle. Because I'm sitting in the middle because...
Thank God you're in the middle. Because.
Yeah. Well, I've got the divine intervention of sitting in the middle because I actually have 9 years of scar tissue on a relevant solution that was tried, and I can report on it so that we all have something constructive to think about. So Ophelia said I was at the Ohio Board of Regents, and... imagine my noisy personality being on the Ohio Board of Regents and deciding that in a state that was going from having blue-collar jobs, particularly in northern Ohio, what was heavy, heavy factory jobs, they were all being eliminated. I started in 1990. So they were all being eliminated at that time. And it was the first time in Ohio that the generation of kids coming up at union jobs were not going to be able to make more than their parents. And it was a seismic shift that nobody was talking about. And the part of the solution, there were no easy solutions, but part of the solution was to be able to get at least 2-year college education, the associate degree education, so people could run the computers and the high-tech machines so that they could do the healthcare that was running the machines, or they could do the factory job that was now having a newspaper printed by a factory guy that, you know, the little robot that runs around and cuts the paper and does the dyeing. And so as a policy matter, we on the Ohio Board of Regents said, we need more money for access because there are lots of kids that need at least a 2-year degree. We hope they all get 4-year degrees, but we at least 2-year. So we went to the legislature hat in hand year after year after year. And I went with Gordon Gee, who was the head of Ohio State at the time, and a hysterical human being. And
he was a president when I was a student.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, and bow tie, the whole thing. And we would go and beg the legislature for more money, and they were making a choice at that time in Ohio to have the excess money go to the build more prisons than to put it in higher education. So we were at a zero-sum game, and so this is laying the foundation. So what we said was there are 35 colleges and universities on 68 campuses that are part of the Ohio system. Okay, so it's OU, Ohio State, Cincinnati, Bowling Green, Kent State, okay, those institutions. At the time, we had 5 law schools in the state of Ohio, which is more than any state except Massachusetts, which includes Harvard Law School. 5 law schools. We had 8 programs that taught PhDs in English. We had 11 that did PhDs in history. And we did what we started with your data, which is could the graduates get jobs using their terminal degrees, whatever their last degree was? Are they getting, is that degree worth it? And from our Board of Regents study, we said, no, most of these programs are junk, and one or two of the law schools ought to close. So what do you do in public institutions? You hire a consultant, okay? But we actually wanted to bring about change. We didn't want to just rant and rave about it. We actually wanted to change. So we brought in a consultant that everybody agreed upon that was going to do an assessment of all of the graduate programs that were duplicative in the state. And the idea that we had was we will take the graduate programs and we will put the money into first year and second year access. And we had the financial modeling to show that we could do it. And we could literally solve the access problem in Ohio by doing it. So we went to the institutions, we got their permission, we did the evaluations, and lo and behold, they showed that half of the English programs should be closed, 2/3 of the history programs should be closed, 1 of the law schools for sure should be closed, and the other one should be scaled back. And we had all of the data. And then we went to the institutions and we said, we're only the Board of Regents. You have a board of directors. You have your own board. We will give you 3 years to decide whether to close that ineffective program, documented ineffective program. If you want to keep it going, raise your own money. But if you don't want to keep it going, you need to know at the end of 3 years, the state subsidy will sunset. I am happy to report that about two-thirds of our access funds actually were rejiggered. There were two or three universities that kept stupid programs open. And most of the programs actually got shut. It often took 5 years instead of 3 years. And we actually increased we lowered the tuition. Imagine this. We lowered the tuition on the branch campuses of the universities, which were doing, so Ohio State had branch campuses that were competing with community colleges. And we said, you can't compete and cost twice as much. So we made the branch campuses lower to community college. All access avail cost effective, and at the time it was $2,000 a year of tuition at the community college level. So we actually made it accessible. And we closed most of the graduate programs, a few were grandfathered. The one failure, and it almost cost me my chairmanship at the Board of Regents, was trying to close a law school.
And I don't need to.
And recognize I'm a lawyer. So but it turns out that almost all of the judges who are in Ohio are elected, had gone to Cleveland State Law School. And they couldn't pass the bar exam if you went to Cleveland State, but you could get elected to the judiciary. And so there was more political power, and that law school is still open. But the reason I'm going on and on about this is there is a solution, but it takes players coming in, and it takes people recognizing that there are zero sums, there are trade-offs. There are people that say, no, I don't want somebody to graduate from with a history degree and only be able to teach high school English with a PhD from Kent State. We get it. We understand. And the ability for individuals to make choices, because as much as I love your declarations of war, they're undoable. And what you need is a systems change with enough people at the table to bring about the system change. At the time I was on the Board of Regents, we were just starting distance learning. And one of the ways we were able to get the branch campus costs down so that they would lower the tuition was they would teach the course only on the main campus and not do it also at the branches. So we literally lowered their cost of delivery of the subject matter to the students at the branch campuses. But it took a lot of granular rational discussion, and at the time the threat of distance learning was great, so people were willing to be a little more radicalized than they were then. So
Reese's point, can I respond to what you said about the private universities and their sort of arms race on tuition? That's absolutely right. People at Harvard say, but if we don't raise our tuition, people take the private. So Princeton's the most interesting case to me because of their relatively small size but enormous endowment because of all their rich alumni. Princeton could pay full tuition and room and board for every single student out of the revenue from its ordinary revenue from its endowment. But they couldn't possibly do that. I mean, or they won't do that for a variety of reasons, for the reasons you point. But it's gotten out of, that made sense maybe 30 years ago, but it's gotten out of hand now, right? So there's that. The other thing is, nobody's brought this up yet, except maybe indirectly a little bit, public university. So, tuition here. By the way, I've only brought up the CU.
I understand. I got it.
Just to make a point, that Hillsdale's actually a really good place. It's not some marginal place where, right?
How big is it?
1,400 undergrad. It's the same, they got some graduate programs are starting. Yeah. But Purdue's pretty darn big. It used to be that, so tuition here is 12,000 something is tuition. At least that's the figure I saw. I wish it was zero. And in the old days, California, it used to be zero at Berkeley and UCLA and so forth. And, in those days, this is 50 years ago, 40 years ago, you got a lot of support from legislatures. And now it's very little, and that's a big complaint. The problem is that I can be colorful about this problem, too, is that higher education is last in line for budget priorities for states, or it's the first thing that's going to get cut. And that's partly because you can trace this out. I did in California years ago. We made a bigger priority of K-12 spending, bigger political constituency. Mm-hmm. And the prisons, crime is a bigger political constituency than higher education is going to be. Although even in California, we stopped building prisons and we're still not getting any money back to universities. And then all the social programs, Medicaid we talked about yesterday on the healthcare panel. All those programs are going to be saved first, and higher education is going to be the first to be cut. And, you know, states are recovering in their budgets, but I don't think we're ever going to get back to the flush days of things like the 60s and 70s. And so I don't think it's ever coming back. I actually worked with President Benson on that Wall Street Journal article he did a couple years ago. Because I know the journal editors. They called me up, how do I get an article in the journal? I said, I'll call Mark Lasswell, the editor. I know him. Anyway. And so that's your biggest challenge, right? And so that's never going to come back. I think that's sad. But that's the new world we live in for public universities. So you have the private universities who have this arms race that's completely insane, and public universities that are, in a certain way now, more like private universities. They've got to raise a lot of private money, and they're going to have to charge their customers when this is supposed to be Berkeley. It's supposed to be open access for everybody. You're right about the diversity point. Although, just one that thing, that's about Hillsdale. When they started in 1844, they admitted blacks and women. So they admitted women 130 years before Harvard did. Just have to remind people about that.
I mean, a spirit of fairness. I think some of my colleague mentioned about the role of the technology in the higher education.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of colleges and universities are getting it. I'm sure you guys heard about MOOC, mm-hmm. massive mm-hmm. open online courses. Obviously, CU, I think, is offering it. Big college and university, they're offering it. It's free to everybody, not only to American and people, you know, in Africa and in Asia. And obviously, it's at this point, it's not making money. But now there are some changes in institutional higher education that we can use this tool and offer a degree and charge people tuition. So I think that's one thing. Even at a small college, I have started, you know, and I think the college giving the faculty some incentive, you know, in order to incorporate technology in their classroom. Mm-hmm. So I started 5 years ago. I teach regular courses, which face-to-face, but at the same time, I'm teaching hybrid courses. The student's supposed to do a lot of the work of your time using the technology, and I meet with the student as not as much as on face-to-face, and I think it's very, really good for a student. It's good for me because I don't have to explain the little thing about economic theories. My job when I meet the student, we can talk about the application, what they were supposed to read. But be honest with you, it's not for all the kids. It's for the student. They have the work ethic, and they are willing and able to do the work on time. Because of the technology, I'm going to tell them this is going to be available for the next 48 hours, and I'm going to close it. And the kids come, you know, remember that, you know, I probably did it myself. They killed the same grandmother in one semester three times, you know, and they begged me, you know, well, could you give me an extension? Could you open it up? And I think so. We are doing these things, but also, it's really not easy. It's a very complicated industry that we're in, and the rules are constantly changing in the institution of higher education. So I think it's a challenging task for us.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical of the online model. I've done a few courses, including some with a platform, actually with Ashland University, mm-hmm. up the road from mm-hmm. Columbus, right, mm-hmm. which does a program for high school teachers getting their master's degrees. And you know, we do these courses where you're actually live. It's not a sort of taped course. And I think it works well for some things. I mean, Khan Academy on those little math tutorials are fantastically good, and a lot of students use those. I think it's better for certain things. Might be for certain economics courses. I think it's harder for the humanities where I still place great, having done both forms, I still create that there's huge value on seeing the whites of their eyes. And the humanities are the parts of higher education that are struggling the most for declining student enrollment, right? Mm-hmm. I think the number of students, even at the Ivy League universities that have the best humanities departments, Harvard, Yale, et cetera, Princeton, the number of students majoring in the humanities has fallen by 2/3 since 1980, mm-hmm. not just since 2008 when people really got conscious of this. And the social sciences, except for economics, have also been in decline.
You're right. There are other challenges with the online courses. I think even you're a college professor, I hate to say it, you have to be cynical. You know, because the problem is, even when I teach, you know, hybrid courses, I do not allow the student take the test in the dormitory using the computer, because it's very easy to ask your classmate, your friend, sit in front of the computer, you know, and take the test. So I ask the student, and I'm not using the computer. I give them old-fashioned exam in the classroom, because, as I said, it's an element of trust. And also, my wife has started this long because we both teach at the same college. She really get upset, and hopefully she's not here, and hopefully she's not going to listen to what I'm going to say, because I have to sleep in the basement when I get back home, you know. But you are right. Online courses is not for everyone. And unfortunately, they are, you know, it's good for some professors. Maybe they don't have the personality, and it's a good idea. I hate to say it, honestly, God, it's a little, but the thing is, what the drawback with the online courses is, technology has is good and also bad. What I see with a lot of my students in the past 30 years of teaching, when they come to your office, they don't have the ability to carry on a decent conversation. There is no eye contact. There is no emotion. There is no, I don't mean be like me, crazy all over like Italian and all, but I think, you know, when they go for a job interview, those are an important skill that you need to use. When you develop a relationship, you know, when you want, I think, you have you been in a restaurant, you know, well, you know, having a dinner and see two couples sitting there and they have a little cell phone, you know, Friday night, we want to have, let's go out and have a quality conversation, quality life. They're on their cell phone, they never talk to each other.
You know,
so that's the drawback with the technology.
My students today, since I'm here, are seeing a videotape lecture for me. I worked on really hard because I don't want to be, you know, I'm actually now scared to death they're going to like it better than me in person, so I don't know.
Well, having raised the online, I don't think it's a panacea, yeah. But I do think that the institution of higher education needs to take advantage of it, get ahead of it, use it as a more powerful tool, and use it intentionally, as this panel is on student debt, to lower the cost of education. We haven't talked about the dropout rate and the number of kids that have to drop out because of student debt burdens. I mean, there are things that we ought to, as a society, be preventing by not having student debt at the paralyzing level that it is now. And I think some online teaching can help.
See, the thing is, you know, this machine is going to complement teachers, but it's not going to substitute them. Let's see if we have.
We have a few questions from the audience.
Yeah, there we go.
Yes.
So I have a question. So my husband and I are here today, and we have two kids. Both are freshmen. One's a freshman in high school. One's a freshman in college. And so last year, when our son was a senior at Boulder High here, he had a choice. He kind of came down. Went through that whole like horrible FAFSA process and college application process. And he came down to a choice between CU and USC in Los Angeles. And Colorado started a program similar to Georgia where he actually probably could have gone here for $5,000 a year. USC was more than 10 times that.
Yes.
He ended up going to USC. But I know it was a very poor decision. But ranked in the top 25 schools in the country. Mm-hmm. That played a big part. He's an economics major there.
Music, but Boulder has a better football team.
Music.
I don't remember.
No, that's true. Because we got lucky this year.
Okay.
We got lucky this
Boulder
year.
Boulder actually did have a good season. He is going in 3 years. He took 32 AP credits, maybe even 2.5 years. He's taken 20 hours a semester. You know, he's doing what he can to mitigate the cost, but still it's so much greater cost to not get much financially. We made too much for that. What is your opinion? Is it like our daughter's going to be in that same position in 3 years, and she's a similar student to her brother, probably have a very similar type choice. Do you think there is value in going to a school like your son went to Vanderbilt, or
I think it's
should be offered a public institution?
I think the blessing of that you all have is that you can give your child that choice, and and it sounds like he's a heck of a good kid because he's being economically responsible about it. He's not just taking that 10x dismissive of it. All three of my boys ended up going to, one went to Williams, one went to Vanderbilt, and one went to Emory. And I paid for part of the graduate school at Dartmouth and now Emory Business School. So, but I consider it a great honor and blessing to be able to do that for my child. I am also thrilled that my children graduated without student debt. Now, I made them work summers and part-time during school, and my youngest son had a job working part-time for the Falcons.
Ooh.
Tell me how cool that is. So I tried to instill in them the economic, but it's so much a personal choice of what the fit is for kids for school. I think the amazing thing in the United States is how strong the public institutions have gotten. And Georgia is not just highly selective to get into, it's a heck of a good school. And if I had it over again, my son who went to Vanderbilt, I'd have had him go to Tech, because I think Georgia Tech is just actually a better school because it's been invested in by the state and the ability to attract good students. But it's such a personal choice.
If I might piggyback to what Lee said, this is the type of a question I get from a lot of parents, you know, being a college professor for many years. And also as a parent myself, I think it's not a very pleasant thing to say, but I think it's true that the undergraduate degree today is the same as a high school degree maybe 15, 20 years ago. And I think getting just the undergraduate degree is not good enough. A lot of the kids are planning to go to graduate school. First of all, I congratulate you because your kid has a work ethic. And honestly, that makes our job as a college professor much easier. We are very grateful to parents like you. And also, I think, again, I'm biased. I think he has the right nature. But the thing is, at this point, when my student applied to graduate school, a lot of graduate school, honestly, God, they don't really, it's important, obviously, the profile of the university, but they don't like it as much as before. If you went to a school A or a school B, they want to know. And grade also is a factor, but as important. For example, you know, what a job, or for a guy, what did you learn during the past 4 years at this institution? They ask you a practical question, and they want to know how you're going to answer the question. So I think, you know, this is a wonderful school. I think, you know, again, same thing happened with your daughter, because we know she was planning to go to medical school, and I told her, I'm not going to pay that much. We were not able to pay that much. I said, if you go to this expensive school, then we will not be able to help you with the medical school. We have to let her make a choice. So she comes home, and I didn't know I should cry or laugh. She was at the high school. So I talked to my friends, and my friends think, you didn't do a good job investing for my college education. Being a goofy econ professor and having one child, I think that was very painful. So prove it wrong. I said, sweetheart, the difference is $150,000. I can write a check for $150,000. You can buy a condo, and it's going to be a good investment. And when you graduate as an undergraduate, you don't have any loan. So.
Just a data point on that. If the kids do go to graduate school, the numbers of the amount of debt, it's 37 for undergraduate. The debt for an MBA graduate these days is 42. For education is 51. For law is 141. And for medical school is 162. So those are the levels of student debt just for the graduate degree that the kids have. So.
Can I take a question?
Okay. My question is, I have a grandson who 4 years ago was offered the $5,000 and a couple thousand more a year in the engineering department at CU. He chose to go to Cal Poly. His parents could pay very little. He's now a fourth-year student. He's not a senior, I've learned, because he's taking another year. He started out swimming Division I out there for 2 years, but he was not on scholarship. He ended up quitting swimming because it's very hard to do engineering and swim. He has over $130,000 in student debt. He has no concept of what it's going to be like to pay this back.
That's it.
And he is very fit and healthy, so because he quit swimming with the team, he does CrossFit as if it were paying his tuition or something, but it's not. Do you have any suggestions how you pay off? It's going to be over $130,000 in loans.
Didn't you ask the same question a few years ago when I was in the same town?
I remember.
I'm one track minded person. I'm going to give you the same answer. One thing you and his parents got to be grateful, and I'm going to get in trouble because President Obama got in trouble when he advised a student not to study art history and study a subject that is going to help you to find a meaningful profession. And he got really in trouble because one author professor wrote a nasty letter to Obama and he had to apologize. But hey, listen, I'm shameless. I'm going to say it. But I think they have to be very grateful because, to be honest with you, I think after he graduated, the probability for him finding a decent job that is going to help him to pay his debt, I think is very great, to be very honest with you. I'm not that worried with that major.
Yeah, but that raises a really important point. I mean, you've got a major that I know some other Cal Poly graduates, they get great jobs out of the engineering school there. And So he's in better chance than our history major.
He didn't get an internship, though, because he went to Spain to study.
Yeah.
And
well, yeah. Well, but even those internships, well, okay. But, you know, one of the things that, so, I mean, I have lots of, you know, complaints about some of the ideological character of humanities and social sciences, but leave that all aside, when college was cheap, when I went to college back around the time of the Boer War, it was cheap, and so you could take a class in speculative philosophy, and, you know, my very hard-headed businessman dad thought that was fine. But nowadays, when it's really expensive, the pressure's on the students, pressure from parents, you don't, you know, that's too frivolous a thing to do. I think this is really hurting the humanities and social sciences because of their, because of the high cost of it, and I wish more people in the humanities and social sciences understood that.
Professor of philosophy at Skidmore College.
Well, there you go, right? So, there you go.
Well, the truth of the matter is there are quite a number of programs that are available that are not accessed very often to have an income-based repayment system. And so when he graduates, what I would recommend that he do is get, there are federal programs that give you the consultation on it, but he ought to get his repayment plan in place based upon his income. And you can do that, you can do it right away, and that means that he'll have the average at the moment now, that the median is 203 a month for repayment of graduate, of undergraduate, the average is 350. He will be able to get a good job, and if he sets it against his income from the beginning, then he can probably level set it. It'll be 10 years before he pays it off. I remember my $61.80 last payment of my student loans as if it were yesterday, and it was a princely sum at the time, 1,000 years ago. But but that's what I would do if I were here. The average, the repayment, monthly repayment for the undergraduate in the U.S. at the moment is, the median is $203 a month. For the just the student debt, the average is $351 a month. That's again. These were the numbers that we were both talking about. The average graduating debt is $37,000 a year, right?
You and know, one quick thing I'd like to point out with the loan debt this high that you're explaining for your grandson, only a portion of that is federal loans, and so I have, because there's caps, so
yep.
I know for a fact that it's not all federal.
Yeah, I don't even know what it's made up of.
Part of it
yep.
would be private, and the program she's talking about would only be for those federal loan
That's
programs.
Right. That's good.
Yep.
Yeah. We have like a bunch of questions, and we're getting really close on time. So,
okay.
You
so I have a question which might be partly for Ophelia. I'm not sure. But after our daughter got out of college, she went to, I don't want to identify it, small professional school. And she recalls once she was in a financial aid place, and she, this shouldn't have happened, overheard a counselor talking to one of her fellow students and said, "Are you sure you don't want to use some of this money to buy a new car?" And so what I'm getting at here is this was in the time of subprime mortgages.
Yeah.
And you haven't talked about irresponsibilities on the part of the financial institutions and the possible collusion between the financial institutions and the academic ones. That's my question.
You're right.
Actually,
I had that one in my note. I didn't have time. This is one, because some of these kids, they have no idea. Honestly, they don't even know that they're borrowing money. Be very honest with you. Some of my students, they have no idea who is paying their tuition. They have no clue that they'll have to pay some of this money back. And again, you know, I'm in the business. Forget them. If I'm running a loan company or a bank, you know, and that's not my concern. My concern is to get the biggest bang for the buck.
Right.
And that's their problem.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there is that.
I know.
Dodd-Frank did.
No, but the parents should advise their children about debt.
Not if they don't listen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, at least try.
Well, my daughter is.
There's always that problem.
This is a good argument for the kids to take at least one economic class. They hate it. Honestly, you can even hate it.
You're kind of get the self-dealing argument sooner or later.
And they'll learn about compound interest.
There you go.
Exactly.
Well, and you know, a lot of like the federal student loans at a, you know, federal policy level, you know, believe that if you just do some entrance counseling and you have students go through a little quiz before they take out those loans, then they understand what an interest rate is
and what capitalization is.
The truth is that it's pretty easy to just click a button and accept those loans each year without really paying attention to how much it's accumulating. I almost would love to see students have to like sign off on what their plan is to repay before they take out that loan.
Really?
You know, might be useful to have students come back that are 5 years out and talk to the freshmen about. Yeah.
That's a very good point. Exactly.
That's part of orientation.
That's perfect.
That's a great idea.
But the thing is, you know, in our college, I don't know about CU, but we are a little afraid, you know, that kids get nervous and don't come back to our college if we tell them, you know, okay, this is what is going to happen. See, I know.
There was a question. You had a question? Yeah.
I think you kind of already answered this, but my fiancé is French, and in France, they have like public, which are effectively free universities, and then they have the grande école, which are specialized schools that are a little bit more reputable and cost a little bit more, but are still cheaper than state tuition here. And then they have private schools. And it seems to me that the schools there are a little less focused on sort of the climate cultural aspects you were talking about, like the gym and the sports, and like the focus is a little bit more on just the education.
That's true.
And I guess I just wondered what your views are.
You're absolutely correct. My wife is from Germany. It's exactly the same thing, for example. Even I grew up in a different another country with a different educational system, and I was amazed, you know, as, and I'm going to get in trouble saying these things. It's not only see other places. The amount of attention we give to people who are involved in a sport, even happening, honestly, at my small college, the coaches, I'm not talking about CU, I'm not talking about Big Aiden, I'm talking about a small private college. The coaches by far get more salary than, honest to God, the hardworking faculty.
Yeah,
but that's taboo. I'm not supposed to mention it. It's a part of American culture. I'm sorry.
Yeah.